Hey, friend. Welcome to Houston Made, a show where I, Rusty Gates, get to talk with local Houston-based entrepreneurs and business owners about what it's like to be in the middle of that journey and selfishly gain insights as I build my own businesses. Last year, my wife and I, we were driving around Spring Branch, and we saw these grapevines growing in front of this beautiful, newly constructed building just across from the silos that you see when you're like I-10 Beltway area. So we got online. We found out that it was Nice Winery. We saw that they had tasting dinner. So, of course, we bought tickets for my birthday that was coming up, and we went. We had some amazing wine. We had some phenomenal food, and we learned a ton, not just about the winery, but also just about wine in general. And that night, I signed up for not one, but two different memberships with Nice Winery, and of course took home a case of wine. And they and the wines that they curate for our memberships have graced our table pretty much every week since then, which is why I am super excited to have Ryan Levy on as the guest this week. He's one of the co-founders, co-owners, and master sommeliers of Nice Winery. And if you've followed the show for a while, you'll have heard me quote Luke Bronner, who is an early guest who also leads Milieu Media, the network where this show lives, when he says that what he thinks we all want is to talk with people that we admire about things in which we are mutually interested. And in doing that in front of a microphone and calling it a podcast gives us the ability to do that with people we would otherwise not have access to. And that is exactly what I got to do with this episode. It would be enough to talk with somebody who's built such an amazing business here in town, but to also get to sit down and have a conversation with a master sommelier about wine, this is like a dream come true. I'm not kidding when I say there are like only a couple hundred, maybe less than that, master sommeliers like in the world. So it's kind of a big deal, and Nice Winery has too. So you'll certainly hear me fanboying out about all of that. So listen in as Ryan and I discuss how he went from being a lawyer to a Cordon Bleu trained chef to a master sommelier, how they were able to bring Nice Winery into its new facility in spite of the pandemic, and the role that the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo plays in the life of Nice Winery. Ryan Levy of Nice Winery, thank you so much for being here. I'm thrilled to have you on as a guest. My wife and I, we are both members of the winery here, and we bought a larger wine fridge as a part of our kitchen renovation, and it is, easily 70% your wine or the wines that come through our membership. So that's affiliated. Awesome. For people who don't know anything about you, which is always surprising to me because you're tucked away right here, but Houston's like that. There's just stuff tucked everywhere. Can you tell us a little bit about the winery, about Nice, all of this?
Yeah, I'm now Nice Winery is this epicenter for wine and culinary education, a place where you can take wine classes, a place where you can have a Napa Valley style experience right here in the middle of Houston. Wine dinners, wine classes, wine tastings. Really, our goal, Ian and I, we're both Le Cordon Bleu trained chefs. We're both certified sommeliers. We're both winemakers. And we want to bring our passion to our Houston friends.
Yeah. It's amazing. This space is amazing. You say now. Obviously, it wasn't always that.
No, definitely not.
Is there a thing you're referencing when you say it's now this? It was something else.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to look up Nice Winery a couple of years ago, we were in a storefront on the Beltway next to the Easy Tag store.
Yeah.
In about 3,000 square feet. And most people, pulled up and said, am I at the right place? And,
yeah.
And they walked in and hopefully were transported to a place like Napa. Mm-hmm. But now we've really fulfilled our dream of having an actual working vineyard right here in the middle of Houston, the very first commercial winemaking vineyard inside the city limits of the city of Houston.
Yeah.
With 240 grapevines and 19 chickens that help keep our vineyard organic and eat all of the bugs and pests in the vineyard and lay eggs and fertilize the vineyard and 100,000 honeybees. We have an apiary right here in Spring Branch, our organic vegetable gardens, so that we can do farm-to-table dinners for our wine club members on Fridays. And it really is a dream come true.
It is beautiful. You guys have built this amazing facility where you do a lot of winemaking here on site, and then you have the grapevines. My wife and I, when she was pregnant with our first son, we did baby moon. Yeah, I think that's what they call it. Like last trip before you're now weighed down with the responsibility of another human being. And we went to Napa, and we had a really great, I guess, OBGYN or whatever it was, who was just like, yeah, you can drink some wine. Like, you'll be fine. Like, don't overdo it, but you have a good time. Like, you know, drink wine, fine. So we went out there, my wife and I, and we loved it. It was our first time. And we kind of had a bad honeymoon experience. And so this kind of made up for that. And what we found is that like the whole like all-inclusive resort thing, not so much for us. We got bored really quickly. It's like, so we're just supposed to get drunk by the pool? Like, that's it? Like,
yeah.
We could do that at home.
Right. Like,
but going to Napa, what we found is we just love talking with people and learning. My wife's an educator, so we naturally just curious people. And we found winemakers of all different sizes. And we found that if we just showed up a little bit curious and not looking to get totally toasted, they would share everything with us, that they would just tell us this wealth of knowledge. And I had already fallen in love with wine before that, but that just really sealed it for me. And we had such a good time. And this absolutely is reminiscent of all of that. The vineyard, the architecture style, everything. So it's truly, truly beautiful. Let's talk a little bit about the journey to get here. Cause you and Ian have this amazing, beautiful story, the going to Paris, you know, y'all met when like 96,
yep,
back in,
yep,
back 96, in the day.
Yep. Yep.
Been inseparable ever since.
Yeah.
And you went to law school.
I did.
And lawyer and had a job. And then you decided, hey, let's go to Paris and study at one of the greatest like places to learn culinary arts ever. Like, how did that happen?
I've always loved cooking.
Yeah.
Cooking was always a passion. When I was younger and kids would be outside in the cul-de-sac playing kickball, I was at home watching Jacques Pepin and Julia Child and Martin Yan on television, and then taking whatever it is that I watched that day into my mom's kitchen.
Yeah.
And absolutely destroying her kitchen. I mean, I got grounded a lot for making huge messes in the kitchen. I was especially fond of, on Martin Yan, he would make animals out of produce. So he would take like an apple and make a peacock out of it. Yeah. And I was really into that. I was like, you know, how many pieces of produce can I cut up into different animals? And I think my parents just, they were a little bit tired of it. They made sure that I understood that there were two acceptable job choices in the Levy household.
Sure.
That when I went to school, I could either be a doctor or I could be a lawyer.
That's it.
And that's it. That was what was acceptable. So even though my passion was cooking, I loved cooking. I loved eating, which I attribute a lot to my grandmother. My grandmother, my dad's mother, she spent every dollar that she had on enjoying life.
Mm.
She traveled. She had season tickets at the opera. She ate out at extravagant dinners, but lived very simply. Had a tiny little, townhouse apartment and not the greatest part of town, you know, drove a late model car, but spent all of her money on experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that really informed the way that I now view life.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, life is not a collection of things you buy,
mm-hmm.
right? You could, like, what do you do with those things? You can't take those things with you. Life is a collection of amazing experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started doing just that, you know, saving away money and eating out and trying new foods and trying to travel to exotic places, you know, every time that I could,
mm-hmm.
Whether it was escaping to India or South Africa,
yeah,
or Thailand, when I definitely did not have the money to do so.
Sure.
You know, hopping a bus to Mexico and, you know, riding an intracity Mexican bus,
yeah,
you know, so that I could go explore.
What ages were you doing that? Like, how early were you like, let's go?
In college, mainly.
Okay.
It was mainly in college.
Yeah. And you're so, already, you're on the lawyer path. So you're, in your parents' eyes, you're already doing the right thing. You're on that journey.
Well, not exactly. So I started as a biochemistry major at
Rice.
Oh, okay. Because I thought I wanted to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And about halfway through, I switched gears and started studying economics and political science and sociology so that I could graduate and go to law school. But yeah, I started as a biochemistry major.
Yeah.
And what's so funny about that now is I look back and I realize that I'm using a lot of those skills that I learned in my, you know, chemistry and biology classes and to make wine.
Yeah, this organic process.
Yeah.
I love wine. One of the things that I'm constantly trying to tell people is I remember reading about aromatic compounds for the first time. And I told you a little bit of my story before. And before I got into real estate, I was leaving the company that I was working at, and the other option on the table for me was wine. It's like, I'm going to go get certified. I'm going to go through the WSET process. And I had gotten a side job selling wine for one of the advertising marketing companies where you set up in a Whole Foods with a plastic table and you say, hey, would you like to try some wine?
Oh my
and
gosh.
Tell them about this $7 bottle
of wine. That is such a difficult job.
It was. Yeah, it was. And it was a hard entry, but even that was like just to get to be around a little more wine and to try a little bit more wine was super exciting. And so in that time, I was reading a lot about all of it. And the aromatic compounds thing really sold me where I was like, no, this is magic. That's what's happening here, which is, this is how I understand it. You're a certified sommelier, so you're probably, you can absolutely correct me. My understanding of it is that when the grape juice and all that goes in, like, to the wine, the tannins and everything, when it goes through the fermentation process, it's molecularly changed at like that level, at a very deep level, so that when you say, oh, this, you know, this smells like citrus, like you're getting citrus notes, that if you were to look at the molecules of that now finished wine and overlaid it with citrus molecules, that you would see like the same shapes within the molecule, within the compound, which is to say that it doesn't just remind you of citrus. It's that at some fundamental level, chemically, it's been made to be more like citrus.
Well, let's rewind it even further.
Sure.
I mean, understand that the phenolic compounds in grapes are genetically distinct from one type of grape to another.
Yeah.
So if we take a Sauvignon Blanc plant and then we take a Chardonnay plant, and we take the grapes off of each one of those plants, they each have genetically distinct phenolic compounds that create what we call in the industry markers for flavors and aromas that are further expressed through fermentation. But all of that starts at the genetic level of the grape or of the plant. People always ask me, they say, you know, what is it that makes, you know, Sauvignon Blanc, Sauvignon Blanc? And you know, we have to kind of break this all down and say, okay, we're talking about a grape.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people don't realize that Sauvignon Blanc is the name of a grape. They'll go buy a bottle of wine. They're like, oh, this is Sauvignon Blanc. What's the grape? I'm like, no, that is the grape.
Yeah.
And that's okay that people don't know that. That's what we're here for. This is what gives me a job, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If people knew that, I couldn't be a wine educator.
Mm-hmm.
But at its core, and I want to roll this back to food, right? Wine is food. Grapes are food. All of the food that we eat are, you know, genetic compounds. They are molecular compounds. They are things that are made up of, you know, elements that have developed over time, and they're all distinct. So when we go into the garden and we, for instance, harvest lemongrass, and we know what we taste or smell from lemongrass, and then we cook lemongrass and it changes, right? Because we've changed the molecular compound of it, and now the aromas may be completely different or more intense. Mm-hmm. Same with, you know, cardamom or saffron. And grapes are no different. Mm. And the, you know, the magic of winemaking is always analogous to what we do in the kitchen. People ask me, oh, you know, I don't understand what happens in a barrel. Mm. And I'm like, yeah, you do. You're from Texas. You ever had barbecue?
Yeah.
You know, what are we doing with barbecue? Mm-hmm. We are imparting the flavor of wood mm-hmm. into food.
Yeah.
And barrel aging is the same thing. In fact, just like with barbecue, where we have applied a certain temperature
yeah.
of heat mm-hmm. to the wood to give us a certain amount of smoke, so too with a barrel, yeah. we've applied a certain temperature for a certain duration of time to give the barrel a certain amount of toast
yeah.
that will extract a certain flavor or aroma.
Yeah.
And this is a lot of it's trial and error. Thankfully, people have been doing this for, you know, a century, and they've learned a lot. And now we have people who do this for a living, a master cooper who works at a cooperage
yeah.
and can tell me as a winemaker, hey, my decades of experience tells mm-hmm. me that if we, you know, expose this particular French oak from this particular forest to, you know, this temperature of heat for this amount of time, it's going to extract flavors that are reminiscent of, you know, dark cocoa or yeah. cinnamon mm-hmm. or clove.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
It's amazing. In Napa, we stayed at this bed and breakfast, like within the town, and they had a newspaper. I was gonna read the Napa newspaper. And I don't read the newspaper, but they had one, and I was awake before my wife, and so I read it. And it's Napa, so a lot of the wine or a lot of the news does have to do with wine and the for the vintners and all of that, like, right? I mean, because it's relevant to their lives. And so there was this piece on there that talked about climate change in regards to winemaking and harvest season getting earlier because of the heat in the summer and all of this. And there was this little paragraph in the article that essentially made reference to this family of winemakers in France who had the temperatures every day of the year for 400 years, or it, like the generations back, that centuries long, they have these books where they have kept track of the harvest dates and the rainfall and all of this. And what I remember kind of seeing in my mind's eye during that is this, that one of those winemakers, generational winemakers, could sit down with this book that just is a ledger of numbers and figures, and that tells them a story. That can tell them a story that spans lifetimes about these particular vines, these particular grapes in this, on this particular plot of land. And I, perhaps it's an overly romantic imagination in my mind, but that it blew me away that, as you said, we get all of those different flavors and notes and profiles from grapes. Yes. And I even, you guys talk about it in one of your wine dinners here. My wife and I came and talked about there are cheap, there are bad winemakers out there that are putting stuff in the wine, diluting it, powders and flavors and stuff to store it because, you know, they want to make it for a dime and sell it for a dollar. And
well, just like so food, on. There's mass produced food
yeah.
and there's mass produced wine.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, in every walk of life or thing that we consume, right, there are artisanal products that are made mm-hmm. by families and made by people. And then there's mass-produced consumables that are made for efficiency.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, if you've read or listened to any Dan Barber and you kind of are a food geek, you know that there became a time in our history where we weren't farming for flavor anymore. Mm. We started farming for durability.
Yeah. Yeah.
We started farming things, apples, for instance, not because they tasted good, but because they had a great shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't, my life is too short for me to choose food based on durability.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm going to eat this particular cut of meat because if I leave it out for 7 hours, it's going to be okay. versus something that's amazingly flavorful mm-hmm. and delicious that I have to cook right now and eat while it's hot.
Yeah.
And so we as consumers, I think, have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. Are we going to, you know, spend a little more and do a little bit more research to have something that is an amazing experience?
Yeah.
Or are we going to settle for a Twinkie?
Yeah, for sure. And that it goes to obviously what's good for you. There's that element of it of, yeah,
these sure. things
are more nutrient rich. And it, for those that are farming in these, you know, older traditions and older styles and saying, we're going to try to get back to how this was done hundreds of years ago. And things were more packed full of nutrients. So there's that element of it. But again, it goes, there's also the story element of it is there's a story with all these foods. When you're talking about the wine barrels that yes, there's these generational vineyards across the world. There's also generational wine, like barrel makers.
Sure. Absolutely.
And that's what they've done.
It's people honing their craft.
Yeah.
Over generations.
Yeah. And how much richer it becomes when all of that knowledge, all of that history, all of that love, I mean, really is pouring into a thing yeah. over that much time. We definitely lost an appreciation for kind of older ancient things.
Right. I mean, I love, you know, there was a point when I was younger that I don't think I truly understood or appreciated what handmade means.
Yeah.
And thought, oh, you know, maybe a machine could do it better. Or a machine could do it, you know, more perfectly. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to wine, it really is about the amount that you are making. Mm. You know, it's just like if you go to a cafeteria where they're mm-hmm. producing a ton of food and going to a very, very small restaurant where there's one person or two people in the back mm-hmm. lovingly preparing a plate of food yeah. for you.
Yeah.
They're just completely different.
Yeah. We in my household, I say my household, it's only me that does this, but I'm in my household. So we say this, but in my household, we refer to Anthony Bourdain as Saint Bourdain, and we have Saint Bourdain Day and celebrate with a big feast and all that. And that's what I always appreciated about the way he introduced people to food through his shows was introducing you to the people. And right. he would always say
right.
that this is not a show about food. This is actually a show about people.
Yeah.
But we can get to those people's stories so much faster if we look at their food. And again, the most romantic stuff is, yeah, there's these five-star chefs, these world-renowned chefs, and they have restaurants that seat seven people. It says, that's yeah. it. And those seven people, and that's what they do, because every dish is made, that handmade, right? It's that hand-sourced. And there's something really, really beautiful about it. Let's talk about the process of becoming a sommelier. So, my understanding is that was Ian's gig first. Like that was, yeah. y'all went to California and
it was.
Ian was going to do this
it was.
Over 2 years. Now, most people aren't going to know the difference between certain programs. Y'all did the Master Sommelier?
So yeah, the Court of Master Sommeliers. Yep. And we trained with an existing Master Sommelier named David Glancy. He currently has a school in San Francisco.
Okay.
It's called the San Francisco Wine School. I'd venture to say it's probably the most respected sommelier program in the country.
Yeah.
And Master Glancy is an amazing educator. And we... you know, Ian enrolled in his school in Campbell, California, and at night, Ian would bring home all of his notes, and we would go and get bottles, and we would train together, and mm-hmm. we worked together, but really people ask me, how long did it take for you to become a sommelier? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, it probably started in cooking school.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I think that a lot of being a sommelier is understanding flavors, understanding aromas, understanding the interplay between food and wine. One of the tests in the sommelier exam mm-hmm. is an actual real life encounter in a mock restaurant. So they set up a mock ballroom, and a master sommelier is grilling you over, you know, what he or she is going to be eating, and you have to have a virtual wine list memorized that you are pulling recommendations from and talking about the interplay between the wine that you're recommending and the food that the master is telling you they have ordered. And to have that breadth of knowledge and not have worked in a kitchen, I feel is really difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how people who become sommeliers that have never worked in a kitchen or never cooked or are not foodies do that aspect. Maybe they score really highly on the other parts but I think that's super important. And talking about Anthony Bourdain, it's funny, my mental wine list, my virtual wine list was from his restaurant, Leal. So I had memorized the entire wine list for Leal. That was my wine list of my fictitious restaurant that I would kind of throw out. And what's funny, if you are doing well, the master sommelier, and the master sommelier in my case, I guess thought I was doing well, will make it really difficult for you. So you know, you'll say, like, he'll say, oh, I'm going to have, you know, this type of fish with this type of vegetable, and I'm going to have this for a starter. And then you'll recommend a wine. He says, no, I'm not feeling that today. And you'll recommend another wine. He said, no, I don't like that region. You'll recommend another wine. He'll say, no, what else do you have? Because he's pressing to see how deep your knowledge goes. Because you could always memorize one thing or two things or three things. And he's really probing to see how deep does that well of knowledge go. Did this guy actually memorize the entire wine list at Leal, all 100 or 200 wines, or is he faking it?
Yeah.
And fortunately, that was one of the parts of the exam that I did really well with. And it was fun for me because I could talk about food and I could get a little bit discussion with the master about, you know, oh, is that really the right food choice for that wine?
Yeah.
You know? And kind of play it up. So it was fun. It really became fun.
That it's amazing. We live in the best time. I just, even with all the terrible things that are happening in the world, we still live in the best time. And to be able to have things like documentaries, that this is a fairly new concept that is spread out so wide, to have the Somme documentaries that walk people through that process to get a glimpse into it, into a world that would otherwise be completely shut off to the public. Yeah. So when you talk through that, I'm like thinking of those scenes in Somme as they go through it and they have to do it. And they're like, no, you need to chill it. No, chill it faster. Yeah. Chill it. No, we're waiting.
And it cracks me up because, of course, there's a little bit of that, dramatization of what happens. And they make it so much sexier than it actually is.
Sure.
Why isn't there's no documentary about people studying for the bar exam, which in a lot of ways is very similar to studying for, you know, the upper levels of the sommelier exams.
Yeah.
And it's because it is not sexy at all. There is nothing sexy about studying for the bar exam.
Yeah.
And I joke because this dramatization of television or when I was a lawyer at that time, the show Ally McBeal was really popular.
Yeah.
And my mom watched Ally McBeal and she asked me if that's what my law firm was like.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, yeah, mom. At the end of the day, all of us go downstairs to the bar, which exists on the first floor of the law firm. And we karaoke together and we drink and sing.
Yeah. And we're all sleeping with each other.
Yeah. I'm like, no, that's not what happens.
No, you're working 80 hours and then crashing. And
so the same thing for sommeliers. I mean, sommeliers work on the floor of a restaurant. They are, in a lot of ways, sometimes a glorified waiter. Mm-hmm. And they work ridiculous hours. They don't get to spend weekends and holidays with their families. I mean, and the same for winemaking, right?
Totally.
People are like, is winemaking just like the movies? You know, and I say, well, it's a little less like Walk in the Clouds and a little more like Grapes of Wrath. And I say that especially after our experience in 2020, because I don't know that I truly understood what it means to be a farmer. because we are farmers now.
Yes,
we work certainly. In agriculture.
Yep.
Until 2020, because the year started off really exciting. We had 3 years ago, we had purchased this property where we're sitting right now to plant the very first commercial winemaking vineyard inside the city limits of the city of Houston. We had, you know, completely remade the soil, planted a cover crop of winter rye, let that lay for a year, then went through and again remade the soil and dug all of our holes and planted our vines, and we're on the cusp of finishing this new home for wine education and food education and wine and food enjoyment in Houston. Mm-hmm. And then March 11th, 2020 is a day that, for me at least, lives in infamy. That's when the state declared an emergency and closed all TABC licensees, including wineries. And we didn't know how long that was going to drag on for. In fact, I was pretty optimistic that it might be a 1 month or a 2 month thing.
Yeah.
And now to look back and realize that that was 15 months. I'd say I don't know how we survived, but I do know. Thankfully.
Yeah.
I know how we survived. And it was loyalty.
Yeah.
Loyalty. Mm-hmm. It was this amazing group of friends and wine club members who felt that Houston deserved a place like this.
Yeah.
You know, we're not a wine bar. You can't come in and get a glass of wine or, no. You know, it's not a place to come and get drunk. We're a place for education. And so it's really this unique place where you can actually go and touch the vines and see winemaking. I mean, we have our barrels, our tanks, our production facility here. And these people just believed in us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It is. And I think that kind of loyalty and your connection to the community, I mean, it's obviously my wife and I, we're members here. And that was a big part of what brought us in, is seeing that this is not just about wine. It's not about flexing. we definitely celebrate the wins here. You guys had an incredible show at this year's rodeo. What was it? I have it written down. 8 new class champion belt buckles. You've got a belt buckle.
I'm wearing one of them.
33 today. Medals at the 2022 Livestock Show and Rodeo International Wine Competition, with a record-setting 12 gold medals, 2 of which being a double gold perfect score award. So congratulations,
Thank you. Thanks.
So obviously, yes, it's good wine. I think it's as close to objectively as we can get. I get that is subjective by the nature of it, but.
And I do want to make sure people who are listening understand what is this wine competition, because I think a lot of people don't know.
Yeah. Even Houstonians. Yeah.
It is now the second largest wine competition in America. Mm. I mean, take a second to let that sink in. The second largest wine competition in America happens in Houston.
Yeah.
How crazy is that? And the judging happens in November. So in the last quarter of the year, about 20 countries around the world. This is not a local or a regional competition. This is
truly
international. 20 countries around the world send what amounts to almost 19,000 bottles of wine to NRG for judging.
Yeah.
And there are a ton of different categories. Mm-hmm. The judging is completely blind. The judges, who are all wine professionals, they do not know what they're judging. I want to contrast that to wine ratings. Mm-hmm. If you see a wine and it's got 94 points, or it has 95 points, or whatever the scoring is, I want people to know that the person who is writing that score, and normally it is one individual, not a team of people, it is one individual, that person knows what wine they are scoring, sometimes knows the winemaker, sometimes knows the winery, and that person derives their income from wine advertising, right? Because they work for a magazine that only exists thanks to the advertising of huge wine corporations.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that they can't be unbiased or they can't be objective, but that is one person's opinion versus a competition where you have 5 judges for each type of wine judging blindly, recording their scores, and then taking an amalgamation of those scores to decide what wine reigns supreme.
Yeah, what's the best wine?
And no one has any dog in that fight because the rodeo wine competition is a 100% charitable endeavor. Mm-hmm. Every single dollar that is raised for rodeo, whether it is entry fees for the competition,
yeah,
or when they showcase the wines at Best Bites, or when they auction off mm-hmm. the grand champion wine, all that money goes to college scholarships for Texas kids.
Yeah.
$550 million.
That's crazy.
Is the amount of money rodeos raised since 1932 for college scholarships for Texas kids. And you probably know this, that I'm so passionate about this, because 29 years ago, I was a kid living in Missouri City, Texas, senior in high school at Dulles High School. My dream was to attend Rice University. I couldn't afford to attend Rice.
Sure.
My parents couldn't have afforded to send me to Rice. But thanks to the generosity of the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, I received a scholarship and was able to go to college.
Yeah.
And what's amazing to me is the idea that 35,000 volunteers at rodeo, people who have never met me, didn't know my ambitions, my dreams, my goals, put in their time, treasure, and talent to help raise money so that I could go to college along with about 400 other kids that got scholarships that year. Mm-hmm. And that says a lot about the community that we live in.
Yeah.
And how much we as a community value paying it forward, giving back, and practicing gratitude, which is a big part of what we do here at the winery.
Yeah. Is that what brought you back to Houston?
It is.
Yeah.
It goes back to loyalty.
Man, I love that. I've talked about this on the show plenty before, but I grew up in Dallas and was bred to hate Houston. Right? It was just a brainwashing that was a part of the curriculum as you grow up in Dallas. And then we move here in 2014.
That's funny that Dallasites are obsessed with that, because we don't really talk about that here in Houston.
Yeah, no.
I guess we're not really concerned with what happens up there. And to be fair, my first restaurant, mm-hmm. I owned and operated in Dallas. I did live in Dallas and practice law in Dallas for 6 years. I have many, many, many dear friends, mm-hmm. and I visit as often as I can to see all of my friends.
I love it, and it's home. But it took a solid, let's call it 8 to 18 months to overcome that, to realize, oh, this is a really cool city. A lot of the complaints were valid, admittedly. But again, why that was needed, like why it was necessary to broadcast that and like make it so well known that it was awful in, you know, the infrastructure and the roads and whatever.
It's also sports rivalries, right?
That totally plays into it. And as not being a sports guy, I never like really picked up on that until later.
I mean, nobody loves to hate any of the Houston sports team, but I think there are a lot of people that love to hate the Cowboys, right? That's like that's like a pastime. So
yeah.
I think they have to find a way to give it back.
It certainly is. We have to flex on something. And but I fell in love with Houston for that reason, for the community. And before Houston, I was in Denver, and Denver was a really cool city because nobody in Denver was from Denver. So mm-hmm. everybody was like, y'all need friends, let's be friends, which was really, really great. But Denver has a transient nature to it that makes it really hard to put down roots, because again, nobody there is from there, much to the natives' chagrin. But then coming to Houston, it has so much of the same, I think, values in that way, where in Houston, you can kind of be whoever you want to be, and there's space for everywhere, space for everyone somewhere in the city, because it is such a diverse city and there's no zoning laws, and you have a winery literally next to the silo, next to the highway, that there's just a place here. And I've met so many people from so many different walks of life, both within the show and then obviously just through my businesses and living life here. And I love it. And this city is amazing. As we get towards the end of all of this, you know, you mentioned you now have a winery, and I can't imagine how many roles you have to fill, right? Because you're farmers. If you are producing grapes, which are a particularly finicky plant, especially when you are trying to produce a very specific fruit at a very specific time with a very specific water content and all of that. So you mentioned addressing the soil. So you can't just throw grapes in your backyard, grapevines in your backyard, and think that you'll produce a championship award-winning wine. So you're farmers, but also you have your winemakers, which is a completely different thing, because in California and around the world, there are people who grow the grapes, and many of them just sell them to winemakers.
That's right.
That's like a separate job, and you're
doing both. Just like Del Frisco's doesn't raise cattle, right?
Exactly.
You know,
but you're doing both of those jobs, and then on top of that, you have all of this. So, kind of, do you have an idea on like how, or is it just all blend together at this point? Because you have employees, so you're a boss, you're an educator, how do you keep all of that straight?
It does all blend together, but I think that at its core, it's about learning and about sharing. Hmm. So whether it's in the vineyard, I mean, our vineyard is a teaching vineyard. Oh, every single day when guests come through the winery mm-hmm. and experience one of our guided wine tastings, it is a class, and we go out into the vineyard. We take every single guest who is here for a wine tasting experience into the vineyard to mm-hmm. see and touch the vines and see what does sustainable farming look like? What does organic farming look like? How do the chickens interact with the vineyard? Why do we have chickens in the vineyard to eat the bugs? How does that work?
Yeah.
Why did we have to remediate the soil? Why did we have to graft the vines? Why are the rootstocks of the vines different than the plants? Mm-hmm. And so everything that we do, I think, goes back to that touchstone of education and learning and sharing and building community, a community of people who care where their wine and their food come from. Mm-hmm. We all speak with our dollars, right? We buy wine, we buy food.
Yeah.
That money supports something. Mm-hmm. We either support small family farmers, organic and sustainable farming, family owned and operated, people who give back to the community, our local people, or we send our money away to huge factories and huge mm-hmm. corporations and publicly traded companies and return money to shareholders.
Yeah.
We make that decision every single day, multiple times a day. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that with a little bit more sharing, a little bit more education, that we're asking some really tough questions when we buy our food and we buy our wine. Who made this? What's in it? How much of it did they make? Am I one of 10 million or one of 10,000? Mm-hmm. And then finally, you know, where's my money going? What's it supporting?
Well, I think that y'all have such an amazing space here, and you make phenomenal wine. I'm always trying to open as many bottles as I can when people come over. I really love introducing people to your port, because a lot of people are like, "Yeah, I've had a cab. I know what that is." Port. Have you had a good port? Let me show you this, and it's amazing.
Thank you.
That's an award winner, right?
I think it is. It is, because this year Washington State was a focus region for the competition. And we won the number one dessert wine from Washington State.
Because it's so good. That's why.
Thank you.
Hey,
141 months in barrel doesn't suck.
No, not at all. It's so good. Well, is there any advice that you would give to your younger self, whether it was the pre-law school Ryan, or it was the chef Ryan, or at any stage, is there advice that you'd look back and wish you could have given yourself back?
Oh, that's super hard. I think just the realization that life is short, mm-hmm. people matter, mm-hmm. relationships matter, and it's the friends and relationships that you make along the way that you'll carry with you for the rest of your life. Everything else is fleeting. Everything else is ephemeral. Mm. But your friends, your relationships, people matter.
Yeah. Well, that is fantastic. And I think my hope is that that's what at the heart of the show is. And I know it's at what the heart is at the heart of all of this. Nice. It's the way that you set up your table to be in the round in a way so that people can taste and look at each other and talk. And then the community here. Well, I obviously am a member and will continue to be a member, and will encourage as many people as I can to come and check y'all out and have some phenomenal wine. So thank you so much for doing this.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for coming and talking about wine with me.
Yeah.
Now we just need to go drink some wine.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Be great. A huge thank you to Ryan and to you for listening to this episode of Houston Made. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed getting to have this conversation, and I'm so grateful for the chance to get to share it with you. If you haven't done so yet, you can follow Ryan and the winery over on Instagram at The Nice Winery, and you can see all of their upcoming classes, dinners, tasting opportunities over on their website, nicewines.com. I am a huge fan of late of their Argentinian Malbec, as well as their Tawny Port. It's 12 years to make it. Mind-blowing. It's absolutely worth stopping by to pick up a bottle, but I definitely recommend that if you can, go to one of the dinners. Chef Randy is a rock star, and he will blow your mind with his cooking. If this is your first time tuning in, we have interviews available with entrepreneurs from all kinds of backgrounds, including coffee roasters, college planners, balloon stylists, and more. If you're interested in connecting further, you can find me on Instagram at Rusty J. Gates or the show at Houston Made Podcast. Houston Made is produced and hosted by me, Rusty Gates. A special thanks goes out to Luke Bronner with Milieu Media for continued support of the show, and Mac Ryan Creative for collaboration on our artwork. Credit for our theme music goes to Old Friends, New Friends. And Houston Made is glad to be a part of the Milieu Media neighborhood of podcasts and storytellers. We are people who care deeply about human connection, and in our neighborhood, we find that connection by hearing and appreciating one another's stories and by sharing our own. To find more shows made by amazing storytellers from all kinds of backgrounds, visit milieumedia.com.